New Zealand-based home renovation company, 6,593% ROAS. Sydney-based solar company, 2,700% ROAS. Hunter region-based bathroom renovation company, 5,616% ROAS. Melbourne-based building company, 13,182% return on ad spend. Adelaide-based solar company, 2,881% return on ad spend. Guys, the list goes on and on. If you're a trade-based business and you work with projects like roofing, solar, bathroom renovations, kitchen renovations, anything like that, head across to tradie.wiki/pod for podcast. tradie.wiki/pod for podcast. Book in a conversation. It is game changing. Understanding what your business is worth when you're going down the path of looking to maybe sell it, or understanding what another business is worth if you're going down the path of looking maybe to acquire it, is extremely important. Obviously, there's a lot of variables that come into play when you're talking about buying or selling a business. And in today's podcast, we're going to dive right into that. Today's the first episode of the three-part series called How to Sell Your Trade Business. This episode is called Valuing Your Trade Business and What You Need to Understand in That Process. I'm joined by my guest, Brandon Jacob. This is an amazing podcast. You're going to love this, and it perfectly tees off this epic series. The next two episodes to come are just as good, if not better. So I can't wait to see your comments, guys. Enjoy. This is for anybody that has ever had a dream one day of wanting to sell their business or looking to buy a business. It's super relevant. And we did our very best to make it as communicatable and as relatable as possible. So if you have any follow-up questions, by all means, you know where to get me, and I'll try and get them answered for you. But otherwise, enjoy the show. Today's podcast has been proudly brought to you by Tradie Web Guys. Tradie Web Guys work with tradespeople only on their websites and marketing solutions to help them stand out from their competition. Everything from web design through to SEO, search engine marketing, content creation, you name it, guys. It is a customized solution for trade-based organizations, and it's fantastic. Head across to tradiewebguys.com.au/apply, fill in the form, and let's have a conversation.
Giving tradies and contractors around the globe the tools to run a modern business. You're listening to Toolbox Talks from the Site Shed. Now here's your host, Matt Jones.
Brandon Jacob, welcome to the SiteShed podcast.
Matt, how are you doing?
We made it.
I made it. I'm here in Portland, Oregon.
Beautiful. Well, from Portland to Sydney, thank you for joining us. I'm sure it's getting a little bit late in the evening there, so appreciate the time.
No problem.
So, Brandon, we are here today to kick off part one of the three steps on taking... It's the How to Sell Your Trades Business series. This is a topic that has been bounced around my community for years now, and there is that myth, which I'm sure you're familiar with more than anyone, of I am my business, I'll never be able to sell my business, I'm the man, blah, 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 whatever, to which I normally say, yeah, well, you're probably pretty much right, unless you learn the right way to do it. So we are here today to learn the right way to do it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because once upon a time, 20-something years ago, these businesses really weren't that sellable. People didn't sell them, right? So to this day, there might be some people who think my business is not sellable, which is utterly false. Any air conditioning or plumbing or contracting business, for that matter, is sellable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I've worked in companies before where the guy was just talking about offline, actually, and he was constantly acquiring companies, like constantly. I think in the few years that I was there, he must have bought and implemented, indoctrinated into their organization, maybe three or four other businesses. So for any listeners out there that think that you'll never be able to sell your business, it is a fallacy. Now, over the years, I've learned a couple of things through speaking with people and I suppose speaking with companies that have sold and all that kind of stuff. And they typically say that the main things they need to have in their business in order for it to be acquirable are things like a database and things like systems and procedures and operating procedures and that kind of stuff. I'm sure we're going to get into that a lot more, but is that kind of your experience as well?
Well, no doubt, right? I mean, because as we get into the discussion about valuation, valuation is driven by earnings, right? And anybody who is going to put a fair market value on one of these businesses is going to be anticipating the continuation of those earnings that that business is able to generate. And obviously the database, the customer database is you know, utterly important to that. Our procedures, could I sell a business that, that is doesn't have the right procedures? Yeah, but the reality is that that business is going to be worth less because they don't have procedures and therefore they're not going to earn as much. So the value is going to be driven by the fact that they don't have as high earnings.
Yeah. So this series, Brandon, we've broken down into three episodes. Today we're talking about evaluating your trade business and what you need to understand. And then in the, in the following two episodes, we're talking about preparing your trade business for sale and then actually selling your trade business. So we may as well, before we jump into the first episode here, I just want to get a bit about your background, a bit about your business, and tell us a little bit about your authorships.
Okay. A little bit about my background. I'm a certified public accountant in the state of Texas. That's where I'm traveling this week. I reside in Texas. I'm a certified public accountant in Texas. And I have been a practicing certified public accountant for 30 years. About 25 years or so, wow, long time. 25 years ago, 20 years, I found myself valuing plumbing, air conditioning, and electrical businesses for American Residential Services, who at the time was consolidating and buying a lot of businesses. And from that experience, I stayed in the trades. I stayed in the trades and developed a expertise in understanding the value. And when we say understanding the value, anything from, I mean, I was on the phone today talking with a $500,000 a year business and I'll tomorrow talk to a $50 million business. So of all sizes. I've also developed a consulting side where I am able to assist sellers in from A to Z to get their business sold. Typically, I wish it was more, but typically A starts in, I'm ready to sell my business now. Certainly have helped businesses prepare to sell and certainly help businesses value and then go on to the sale process and actually get a transaction done. The third thing that I do, Matt, is also help contractors buy competitors, right? So, I mean, it's just the same thing, but going in a different direction.
Love it. And you're an author. You're a published author. Tell us about the books.
Oh, the books. Okay. I published two books. The first one a few years ago is For What It's Worth. And For What It's Worth is an industry-specific book on how to value your air conditioning or plumbing business. And it takes you step by step. Certainly, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about today are covered off in the book. It's an easy read. It is a quick read, but it gives the contractor the ability to say, ah, I get it. The second book is called Operation Exit Strategy. And the subtitle to that book is Mission Critical Items That You Must Know Prior to Selling Your Business. So it's the next step. And I know the value of my business now from my first book. And now I need to figure out how to prepare my business to sell it in the second book.
I love it. Well, you'll be glad to hear that our audience base are avid readers, and there's always questions popping up in the group about what book is a good book to read at the moment. I run a bit of a YouTube chat. Well, I must admit, I've been a bit slack on it lately because I just haven't had the time to review a lot of these books I've been reading, but I'll definitely get hold of those and have a read as well. And so...
Very good. I'll send two copies to you.
Perfect. Done.
Let me do that.
Okay, great. And so
So let's jump right in. Of course, as well, I should just say, every time I try and hit record on a podcast button, the neighbor next door decides it's a good time to do the lawn mowing. So if you can hear something in the background, that's what that is. But anyway, we'll try and not focus on that. So, Brandon, let's start with the basics. Market value. What's the go with market value? What does all that mean?
Right. If you're going to get into talking about the value of a business, and Matt, I talk about contracting businesses, but this is any business, right? We're not making this up in our industry. This is any business. We define the term as fair market value. And fair market value isn't a name that is dreamt up without a definition. It's actually defined by the Internal Revenue Service here in the United States, defined as the price at which a business would exchange hands when both the buyer and seller are not acting in a compulsion, and both the buyer and seller have the relevant understanding of the relevant facts. Okay,
what does buying in compulsion mean?
Okay, compulsion would be an example. Would be, I'm a contractor, and unfortunately, I have health problems. I have to sell my business. And I have to sell it in 2 months. That's a compulsion. On the buying side, an example of a compulsion could be, we need to expand our business into this market, and this one business is the only real good opportunity for us. Now there's a compulsion to buy that business.
I'm with you. Okay.
Relevant facts, obviously, we know that, right? I mean, if I'm a buyer and I haven't done my due diligence, I certainly might pay more than fair market value because I do not have all the relevant facts.
Great.
Oh, and as a seller, okay, as a seller, if I don't listen to your podcast, if I don't take the time to read books and study up on these things, I certainly could sell my business for less than fair market value because I'm not operating with all the facts and knowledge.
And if we're honest, most people that are out there looking to acquire businesses are hoping that people that are selling businesses don't know how to do it, right?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, people will gladly buy your contracting business for a heck of a lot less than fair market value. I mean, they'll gladly do it.
Okay, cool. So what about those? I mean, I suppose when we're talking about, you know, both parties obviously wanting to be willing, not acting under compulsion, does that correlate to things like, I mean, I know I've been in situations before where not a client of mine, he was looking at acquiring a different vertical. So he was a plumber, he wanted to buy a electrical business. And I was saying to him, you don't know anything about electrical businesses. He goes, oh yeah, I know, but I'm a good, I understand how to run a plumbing business. So that's fine, but there's a lot of work you need to sort of do in the lead up before you can go just automatically bolt on electrical business or plumbing business. And then he said, well, yeah, but I've only got a short window of opportunity here to get this, to buy this company, or someone else is going to get it because it's a steal. And I was thinking, yeah, but if you buy it, you're going to cock it up. Would that come under compulsion in your opinion?
I don't know if I call that a compulsion. I think I might call that a bad movement. That's a desire, right? And, you know, I would hate to see somebody who is executing in one trade jump into another just because there's a good deal on the table, right? I mean, that sometimes doesn't work out well.
So, I mean, that old saying, you know, my business is only worth what someone's willing to pay for it. We hear that all the time. How does that fit into this equation?
I mean, and I hear it all the time, and it kind of makes me laugh as well. That, you know, hey, at the end of the day, my business is worth whatever someone's going to pay. And it's false. That's a price, right? I mean, Matt, if I called you and said, hey, Matt, your business that is worth $1 million, I'll pay you $50,000 for it. That's not the value. right? You might make the mistake and sell it to me for $50,000, but that's not the value. Again, it's simply the price. And going back to contractors who are preparing to sell their business, having the relevant, you know, getting the relevant facts is important, because again, there are lots of buyers out there who will gladly give you a price, and that price is significantly less than fair market value.
So we touched on it a little bit at the beginning, but I'm curious, like when we're talking about like evaluating a business, what are some of the areas, and by all means, we can dive further into systems and we can dive further into databases by all means. But I mean, what are some of the other areas that you'd take into consideration when you're talking about the business valuation?
Are you talking about the different approaches and methods that might be taken?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm just wondering what that whole model looks like when you're saying, okay, well, I'm going to evaluate a business. What are we taking into consideration here?
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. You know, most importantly, hands down, if a client calls me and says, "Hey, I'd like you to look at my business immediately. Could I see your historical financial statements?"
Right.
I mean, that's, and again, whether it's an air conditioning, plumbing, electrical, whatever the business is, we're going to start with the current or the historical financial statements.
And what are you looking for?
I'm sorry?
What are you looking for there? What are you looking for in the financials?
Looking for earnings, looking to see how well the company's performed. And that's where, and it's certainly covered off in my book, you know, I understand that a set of historical financial statements from a privately held company is always going to have to be scrutinized to ensure that we're not incorrectly placing a higher or a lower earnings on that business. And that comes into things that at times go through these businesses. An owner might pay himself an excessive salary. An owner might pay himself no salary. So we have to take that into consideration in order to recast the historical earnings.
I imagine there's a lot of things too. Like, I know this definitely doesn't happen in the United States, but I was speaking to a guy yesterday in Australia here who was a builder, and he's had the last 6 months off doing work per se, but he's been maybe working on his own home and maybe using it as a bit of a tax deduction. I'm sure that doesn't happen in America. Definitely happens in Australia though. So, I mean, those that sort of situation, I'm sure, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you want to show up in a financial analysis, right? Because that's directly affects.
But let me speak to that. It happens. That's the contractor's own moral compass. But at the end of the day, in the 20 years that I've been doing this, I've actually observed less and less of it, believe it or not. Less and less of it. What I see a lot, Matt, would be, I own the building. I'm a contractor and I own the building in a separate corporation. And I pay perhaps a higher rate than if I was renting to a third party. And that moves some money out of his air conditioning business and into the corporation that owns the rent. That's not tax fraud. He's going to pay taxes from the corporation that's receiving the rent. Right. Using the example of salaries, a lot of guys, they take out a lot of money in salary. And we always have to look at that and say, going forward, when someone buys this business, the person who is going to be in that seat of the owner, he's not going to be paid the same amount of money that the owner was paid. You know, and then let's not forget, probably more important, definitely more important than like small things, you know, personal gas and cars and things like that, would be one-time extraordinary expenses. Okay, let's use an example. I repaved the parking lot in front of my shop, and it was $50,000. And although something like that should be capitalized and amortized, I don't know, maybe it was incorrectly expensed in the year that paving job occurred. Well, that's not going to happen again, right? Or, you know, 30 years from now, it's going to happen again. So something like that would be adjusted to increase the historical earnings.
Interesting. So what sort of time frame are you looking at when you're going back and looking at the history? How many years of records would you go back and analyze?
How many years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, it's my funny accent.
You know, that's a very good question, because it's actually, let's really make sure everybody hears this. Really, 3 years. Some valuation professionals like to look at five, but my history with buyers, private equity companies, third-party buyers, just my experience has been really 3 years, and the rest is ancient history, which is really good, which is good news, right?
Because
a lot of these guys, you know, wow, I had a bad year back in 2007. That doesn't count.
So, I mean, there's many ways to skin a cat, I suppose. I'm sure it applies to valuations. Like, how are there different methods that you use in evaluating different types of businesses?
No doubt. And there's three different approaches or methods that can be used to evaluate business. And each one's used in a specific situation. I'd be glad to run through those real quick if you would like me to.
Yeah, fire away.
All right. The very first is market approach. And that's an approach that valuation professionals use to value businesses, or it's very popular in real estate, right? And an example would be in a neighborhood where three homes that are in the same neighborhood that are similar in size, similar in condition, and similar in the time frame, sold for, say, $200,000. Well, then we could draw the conclusion that that fourth home is also worth $200,000. It's very simple, right? I mean, you know, that's what his sold for, so this is what mine could sell for. However, here's the problem with that approach when we're talking about our businesses, our plumbing and air conditioning and electrical businesses. There are no comparables, right? You can't go to any town in the United States and say, there's been five companies, all the same size as mine, all the same work mix as mine, in the general area as mine, and it would be very tough to get an accurate valuation by trying to get comparable data. So, I mean, do you consider it? Yeah, on every valuation. Do you use it? No.
Okay. But I mean, I suppose there's a lot more variables when you're talking, when you've got something that involves people, isn't there, than you know, where property is just brick and mortar, but when you've got people involved, you know, reputation, process, market, I suppose.
Well, right. I mean, that's a great example, right? Because each one of you and work mix, let alone work mix, right? I mean, you're certainly going to look at the value of a business that's involved in new construction. That's going to have a higher risk and a lower value than a business that isn't. So that market approach probably wouldn't really capture that.
What about including things like cash in the business, equipment, assets, property, blah, blah, blah? How does that come into play?
Well, let me first talk about the next approach, and then we're going to swing back in when we talk about the third approach, about how that's factored in. But
okay,
the asset approach, Matt, would be a situation where, unfortunately, we're valuing a business that is unprofitable, hasn't been profitable, hasn't shown profits in 3 years. Okay, so what's the theory behind that, right? Well, I've got $500,000 of vehicles and furniture and everything else, but my business doesn't make any money. Each year it loses money. Well, at the end of the day, those assets could be sold, and the money that's gained from selling those assets could be invested and made money somewhere else. So the theory goes back to the value of that business, unfortunately, is the asset value. And I've certainly have seen very small, unprofitable businesses sell for assets plus, you know, maybe just a little residual on your revenue, but beyond that, there's not much value.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and you hear of all the, you know, the glit and glam sort of stories about, you know, Instagram selling to Facebook for $1 billion and they never made a cent, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I suppose that is that the difference between the tech space and, you know, the contracting space? Like it's just chalk and cheese.
Yeah, I have yet to see someone pay 1x revenue or 10x revenue for a contracting business that was or wasn't making money, right? But yeah, again, it really comes down to, in our world, the ability for your assets to make earnings. And, you know, that kind of segues into the third approach that I'd like to dive into, called the earnings approach. And in this way, you know, we look at it as, here's the earnings of the business. This is what this business is capable of generating. And we go in and value it by adjusting the earnings, calculating a consistent, what is the consistent earning stream, and applying a multiple of earnings to that earning stream.
So what sort of things are you specifically looking at there? Are you looking at things that can be further optimized and improved within the company? Is that the idea?
Not necessarily in a how they could improve is what you asked.
No, is it things that can be improved, like optimized, done better?
Not so much an evaluation, because you're looking at history, right? I mean, that's really a byproduct of the valuation. Gee, Brandon, why is, you know, I thought my business was going to be worth a whole lot more. You know, what could I do to improve it? Certainly. Do I get into improving systems and things like that out of evaluation? No, I don't. I really point to the fact that the earnings, you know, this is what drives the value, and really point them to earnings. And, you know, it's certainly there's risk factors and items that I call out in evaluation that say, oh, I get it. This is why the earnings are not as high as they need to be.
Interesting. I was just curious, because I thought, you know, in instances where you're at, through conversations I've had in the past with contractors that have bought companies, and they kind of look for weak spots in other companies that they're looking to potentially acquire, where they can effectively plug in their systems, plug in their procedures, and basically take what they've got there with this existing model, plug their stuff into it, and try and explode it that way.
You're asking, does a model work for acquiring a database and then running it to your business?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if they've got a database and they never market to it, or if they market poorly, or if they've got, you know, they've got products and services, but they're undervalued, they're not charging enough, you know, those sort of things where somebody can look at it and go, well,
you hit the nail on the head. I mean, if I'm an operating contractor and I go to acquire a competitor, whether it's in my market or, you know, the other side of town, that's the only reason why I want to acquire that business. I mean, and I'm going to hope that possibly it's underserving its clients a little bit, right? Because I know I could improve that. We're kind of getting off the subject of value, but it's fine.
Right.
Probably not, Matt, as a acquirer, going to over rely, unfortunately, on the technicians that are going to come with that kind of business, right? Because they probably
are going to get fired.
They're at that kind of business for a reason, and they're probably not going to fit into my regiment.
Yeah. And so,
let me be very clear. There's been contractors who have been wildly successful acquiring smaller businesses, integrating the database into their database, and marketing off to the races we go.
A fellow on the show called Tommy Mello. Do you know Tommy Mello? Have you met him before? The home service millionaire?
I know his name, but I do not know him.
Yeah, well, he's got a garage door business, and I think he's in Arizona, actually. But that does the same thing. He basically just acquires smaller companies, plugs his systems in, and then moves on to the next one, buys the next one, plugs his processes in, keeps moving to the next one, and he's a pretty successful dude.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. Sorry to take you off track.
It's been it's been proven to be, that's fine. It's been, it's very successful. The only piece of advice I give the people, clients, when they call and say, hey, you know, I'm looking at a business, is, you know, is your business in shape? That's right. You can't fix your business by buying somebody else's.
And so
you can certainly bolster your business.
Where does goodwill fit into all of this?
Where does goodwill fit into it? First, let's define goodwill. Goodwill is the value of all intangible assets. Okay, what's an intangible asset? Intangible asset is something that we can't touch or feel. This pen is a tangible asset. I could touch it. An intangible asset are things like the customer's or the company's reputation, the database, the name, the telephone numbers, things like that. So when I go to buy a business and I pay $2 million for a business and it has $500,000 of assets, I'm paying $1.5 million for the intangible assets. And going back to the earnings approach, that's how we put value on the intangible assets, by applying a multiple to the historical earnings. When we value a business based on assets alone, because it doesn't make any money, what we're saying is the intangible assets have zero value.
Interesting. So is that part of the advisory process that you would recommend to people, improving the goodwill of a company so that it is more sellable?
Without a doubt. I mean, right, that's the whole secret sauce, is the higher the earnings, the higher the goodwill value.
Gotcha.
Right? And it's actually extremely simple if you stop for a minute and think about it. What comes with better procedures is what comes with better technicians. What happens with better systems, higher earnings? And naturally, as a buyer, that's a company that's going to be less risky, because it's more likely going to stay intact subsequent to the purchase.
Yeah, okay, I'm with you. Interesting. Yeah, I was wondering, I've never really had that explained to me. I've heard it in passing, I've read it in books, but I've never really had a full grasp of that whole goodwill term, which is good, because I mean, I suppose it puts things in perspective for the listeners and the viewers out there too. You know, they might be thinking, well, I don't have a lot of assets. Okay, well, you don't necessarily need a lot of assets.
And it's important to say that if I did a value of your business on the earnings approach and valued the intangible assets, the value of those assets used to generate the earnings come with that valuation. Meaning, I don't say, here's the fair market value of your business and also the value of the assets, right? I mean, going back to the business that sells for $2 million with $500,000 worth of assets. Well, those $500,000 worth of assets, they are needed. They're the fleet, they're the computers, all the tools. They're the things that are needed to generate those earnings, right? Yeah, so it's all tied up in one neat little box.
Yeah, I'm with you. So when you're talking, like moving along a little bit here, I've got a question about the important value drivers. What really matters? What counts when you're talking about the value drivers?
Obviously, earnings, right? We kind of discussed that earlier. But what's going to drive the multiple of a company are the individual risk factors of the business, right? The size of the business. How many years of business has been in business? Does it have management, right? I mean, certainly a business that, and not all your listeners are going to be big enough to have a manager, right? But when we get into that realm and we start having layers of management in the larger businesses, obviously that's going to have less risk to a buyer, because those managers are going to be relied upon to continue the operations of the business going forward.
Just on that though, is that something that you can put into a contract when you're selling a business? Like, can you say, we'll sell the business with this manager? Like, what if the manager becomes a bit of a commodity, doesn't he? Like, couldn't he just turn around and say, well, I'm leaving?
I mean, you know, what a great question. It's a wild card, right? I mean, the buyer can only hope, right? I mean, think about the risk that a buyer's taking.
Totally.
Buying one of these businesses. You know, all the owner could say is, yeah, this general manager is great, and he's been with me for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, and he's going to continue to work hard for you. And it's an absolute
gamble,
big risk. Yeah, absolutely. Because there is no, I mean, what larger companies might do is might come in to the key people and perhaps give them some kind of incentive to stay because they realize how important it is.
Or I've
but seen, let's back up, and it's important.
I've seen a lot of companies as well when they acquire. I've seen companies before when they're acquiring other companies. The management's normally the first ones to go because they want to basically plug their own management in, right?
Not so much with air conditioning, but not okay. Contracting businesses. It seems like, I mean, really the intention, again, I'm talking about a third party buying a business and operating as a whole, not a contractor buying another contractor,
okay,
right?
Okay.
That's a totally different thing. We're going to see attrition in that situation. But if I'm buying a business, I'm a $6 million business, and I'm getting into the contracting trades, I'm pretty much going to want everybody to stick around as long as possible until I get my hands wrapped around.
So what about the actual process of evaluating a business? I mean, I imagine you'd approach a lot of company owners and directors and stuff, and they'd be thinking, I don't want to give this guy access to all my books. Like, that's an intimidating step. They're going to uncover all my dirty laundry.
You know, it's fascinating. I don't look at it that way. I mean, first of all, I appreciate you asking this question because, you know, 20 years of doing this, you know, I treat each and every one of my clients' information as if it was, the biggest secret in the world. I have to. I'm a CPA. I'm bound by a client confidentiality. Number two, I don't have a reputation in the industry that I have by going out and talking about things. So people are putting trust into my hands. And again, you know, here's my financial statements, and yeah, there might be one or two things that need to be adjusted that might or might not be copacetic. But again, I just don't, it's not my position to judge. It's my position to fully understand the real earnings of that business.
Okay. So what is some of that, like from your like perspective and experience, like what does that process look like? The valuation process look like?
If you were to call me up and say you'd like your business value, it's as simple as doing an on-site for larger businesses and being able to observe the process and meet the people in the business. Not 100% of the times, not everybody is going to open their door to all their key management. And then it's gathering data on the business and put into a valuation model that I've used to do thousands of valuations. It's again recasting the historical earnings and then calculating a multiple that's specific to that particular business that I'm valuing.
Just out of curiosity, when we're talking about like the historical periods, okay, so you said before like 3 years is ideal. What if like one of those 3 years, or what if the fourth year was a terrible year and they just totally tanked? What does that do to the value of the business?
Or a seesaw, right? I would immediately, in the valuation process, would want to understand, you know, why is, you know, 2017, what happened? You know, because it could be a timing difference in their financial statements. And we want to certainly understand to make sure it's not that. It's going to affect the value. Granted, if it's the third year out, you know, the 2016, say, you know, that's not weighed as heavy as 2018 at this point. Right, considering I was doing a valuation as of the end of 2018, I put a bigger emphasis in the calculation. I look at the earnings streams in several different ways. I take the 3-year average, the 3-year weighted average, the most recent year. So you could see that bad year in 2016 starts to get not as significant. Now, where it can, and we're not getting into discussing the sale process, it certainly could hurt somebody in the sale process. And if someone was looking to sell their business and I did an evaluation as of 2018 and 2016 wasn't good at all, you know, my advice would be, you know, where are you in 2019? Replace 2016 with a new 2019 and your valuation is absolutely going to be higher.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I know you've spoken a lot about multiples, and for the listeners and the viewers out there, I'm sure they're thinking, well, okay, if I'm going to sell my business, then obviously I want to get a higher multiple. And then if they're thinking, well, I want to buy a business, so I want to buy a lower multiple. What are we actually talking about here in regard to multiples? Like, what's a bit of a background on the different things that could potentially
be? I mean, it loosely comes down to an expected rate of return based on the risk of the business. And obviously, right, the higher the multiple, the less risk that's perceived by the buyer, right? Because you can pay more money for that business. You know, it kind of drives me crazy because I hear people to this day come up and say, what's the multiples? And, you know, there's no secret, you know, it's somewhere between 3 and 7, but that's a pretty wide range, Matt, right? I mean, and then there are much bigger businesses that could even sell for more. Some things are going on in industry that certainly could be higher, but what we're talking about today, your viewers, you know, I have a $2 million business or a $10 million a year business, you know, it's going to fall somewhere in that range. And the only way anybody could calculate or come up with an accurate multiple range is to really take a hard look at the risk factors of the business. It's impossible just to say, oh, it's a 5 multiple. That's what it is. That's not responsible. And most important too, we're talking about multiples. Let's, again, the historical earnings, that's the real thing that drives the value as well, right? I mean, if we have 1 year that has no earnings, you know, that's certainly, we're taking that earnings streams times that multiple. So it's those two things that really count.
Okay. So it's kind of...
not just the multiple. Not just the multiple, because I hear people, that's all they want to focus on.
You hear about, I mean, and if I'm asking questions here that you're going to address in the following episodes, then just tell me to shut up and we can come back and get them. But I'm just curious, a couple of things before we get to the end of this episode, which has been great. Thank you. People and coaches and all these kind of things always encourage business owners to build with the end in mind. And you see a lot of these, you know, you hear a lot of things about exit strategy, and apparently there's some good books that people can read on them. I don't know. Maybe you can help out in that regard. But I'm wondering, with, you know, building a business with the end in mind, do you include things like, okay, this is how I want to build my business so it could potentially be acquired down the track?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, and it's funny because, and it is kind of getting to the next podcast, but let me address the question. You'd be shocked how few people really follow that concept of I'm going to build to sell. And the ones who do are multimillionaires. But you don't have to spend 25 years doing that. You could listen to this podcast and read this book and go, you know, in the next 3 years, I'm going to finish it to sell, right? You know, and there's several things that people do. Obviously, again, I'm going to go back to it. Is, you know, consistent accounting and driving the earnings. And then there's a million other small things that somebody should certainly take into consideration before they say, hey, my business is for sale. So, you know, absolutely. So, again, the build to sell concept doesn't have to be a 25-year run. It could be, hey, I've been in this industry for 15 years, and you know, let's put some time into thinking about my exit in the near future. And you know, Matt, if you're listening to these podcasts and participating in some of the alliances out there and talking to some of the leaders in the industry, it's just a matter of really maintaining momentum in a good business. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. No, it's great. Yeah, I've just always wondered how that would look from somebody like yourselves that actually is in that space. I mean, you hear, you know, all these business coaches and experts giving you their 2 cents, which they probably have no idea on what it looks like to sell a business or what they should be looking for, or, you know, what somebody like you looks for when they come along to buy a business.
You know, and let's talk about, it's funny because I there's a lot going on right now, and I've heard people say things that, you know, wow, that's not necessarily right. And that's kind of, you have to be, before you give out advice on some importance of this, you really should know what you're talking about. And one of the old adages that, is that the right word? One of the old theories, and it certainly existed when I first came into the industry 20 something years ago, was service agreements and the value of how important service agreements were to the value of business. And I think even at one point, Matt, there was a theory that there were a certain amount of dollars that you could pay each active service agreement. And, you know, do not get me wrong. I'm not sitting here on this podcast saying service agreements are not an important part of a contracting business, because they are. And they certainly are attractive to buyers, but I've certainly been involved in business transactions where, for whatever reason, the business didn't focus on them, and they were a large business, and the number of service agreements was not great, and it sold, and it sold for very, very good money. So, you know, it's things like that we have to be careful, because you could kind of, wow, my business is not ready to go, my service agreement program isn't perfect. Yeah, but you know what? What is perfect? There might be 20 other things that are, and then it's a weakness perhaps, but not, it could be overcome. Does that make sense?
I mean, if you look at the fundamentals of a service agreement, in my opinion, and tell me if I'm wrong, but effectively a service agreement helps you re-engage with your customers. It keeps them coming back to you. It gets your foot back in the door. So although somebody might be out there listening and watching this, say, they might think, well, I haven't got a service agreement. But if you've got a good way of engaging with your database and engaging with your customers, and you've got that good, you've got goodwill, then it's effectively the same thing, right?
Again, so there's no confusion. I'm building a business to sell. I'm building the business to add value. I certainly want to put time into my service agreement program, because it does build goodwill. It does build reoccurring revenues. Private equity guys love that word, reoccurring revenue. It shows me that, yes, we have a program that's continuing. We don't see this every day, but you certainly have seen it in the past. You know, be careful of too many bells and whistles on your service agreements. Yeah, we promise to come out for the next 10 years. Those could actually hurt a business in a transaction situation.
Yeah. Over
because now I'm a buyer. I mean, it's one thing, Matt, as a buyer, oh, I've got 1,000 service agreements and on average, I have to go see each one of those one time. I get it. That's my opportunity to touch that customer again after the transaction, right? And that's a good thing. But if I'm buying a service agreement base where they think they have 10 years of visits, now all of a sudden I'm like, it's a liability. Wow, I'm not going to get paid. it's now a liability. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's been great. Is there anything that you wanted to add to the to this conversation before we close off?
No, I look forward to doing the next two pieces. I appreciate you having me on. You know, you were nice enough to let me plug my books right now. They're available on my website. I know that you'll give out my information when you wrap up. And
I mean, for the guys out there that want the book, obviously all the links will be in the show notes, so you can head across there and get them. But
contractors with CFO.com.
Okay.
ContractorsCFO.com.
Right.
Hey, Matt, I guess the final, there is one final thing. It all starts with evaluation, right? I want to sell my business. And we could talk hours about 3-year exit strategies and what do I have to do to prepare my business, when it really, your preparation to sell your business starts with evaluation, right? Because you just don't know where you are. And what's so great about evaluation is, oh, okay, wow, I was hoping my business was worth $2 million and it's only worth $1 million. Let's see what I do in the next 2 years. And now I have a barometer to gauge it with. Does that make sense?
Like a benchmark.
Yeah, and that's what I call my valuations, benchmark valuations.
Right.
So absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's like you were saying before, you know, what you get to measure gets improved. Oh, maybe that was a conversation I had before I spoke to you. I can't remember. Somebody was saying, you know, if you've got, sorry, I was just saying, you know, you've got to have the have a benchmark so you can see how things have progressed or digressed.
And also, I mean, here's another crazy reason why it might not be a bad idea to have a valuation is, you know, you just don't know when someone might knock on your door, right? And that's the best time to really sell a business. It's right, you're operating, you're growing, and things are great. And all of a sudden, you know, someone knocks on the door and they're acting in a compulsion. And because you have a valuation, you can quickly determine that, wow, they are really offering me something that I maybe should take into consideration.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. Well, mate, thank you very much for your time. For the listeners and viewers out there, that was the first episode of How to Sell Your Trades Business with Brandon Jacob, CPA from Contractors Financial Opportunity. Their website is contractorscfo.com. Guys, if you have any questions or any follow-ups or anything like that, you can by all means head across to the Facebook community where you can join the discussion over there. Or if you want to send an email through or you want to post a comment on wherever you see this come through on social media, I will endeavor to get Brandon back on the show to answer any specifics you may have. Brandon, thank you once again, my friend. It's been wonderful.
Hey, and if anybody wants to email me, Matt, you'll give them my email. I'm glad to answer questions.
Yep, absolutely. I'll put all that in the show notes for you. I'll also put a link there to Brandon's book where you can get hold of that. Books, plural. I hopefully by the time you guys see this, I will have read both of them. So I look forward to those coming out as well, those reviews. Brandon, let's sign this one off. Thank you again, sir. We'll be back for part two, where we're going to be talking about preparing your trade business for sale.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Toolbox Talks. If you're liking what you hear, then you can head across to thesiteshed.com where you can join our community by signing up to our Toolbox Talks. You'll get sent a weekly notification, which is basically a highlight of everything that we've spoken about during that week, along with any other industry news that may be relevant or specific to the trades. If you're enjoying the show, you can head across to iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, where you can leave us a review. That would be fantastic, and all the reviews get read out in the show. Likewise, if you have any friends or colleagues that you think would benefit from the show and the episodes that we create, then please go ahead and share it with them. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Please, if you did, head across to iTunes and leave us a review. We would very much appreciate that. Anyway, if you are a project-based trade business and you work in solar or bathroom renovations or kitchen renovations or roofing or something along those lines, and you would like to see some of the results that we've been showcasing in our marketing on for your business, thousands of percent return on ad spend, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 7,000, 13,000% return on ad spend, please head across to tradie.wiki/pod for podcasts. That's tradie.wiki/pod for podcasts. It will be well worth the conversation, and I can't wait to chat with you. Ciao.